Okay, I'm recording. You've heard the saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's what this show is all about, building awareness to end domestic violence. And yes, we do believe it's possible to have a violence-free future. And we think that after listening and learning, you will too. Each episode, we'll be breaking down different aspects of the work. We'll talk to survivors, advocates, community members, and others to explore the things that are happening right now and the work that still needs to be done. So from the Women in Distress Education and Prevention Team, I'm Emily Janis. And today on the podcast, an ounce of knowledge is worth a pound of action. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned. It's October again, which is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And an essential part of building awareness is, of course, building knowledge. So today on the podcast, we talk about what abuse in relationships actually looks like and how understanding that can help us support survivors and end violence in our community. To do this, I sat down with some members of our education and prevention team here at WID. Let's listen into the conversation.
Hi, I'm Brittany, and I am the teen dating violence specialist here at WID.
Hi, my name is Elisa, and I am the education specialist here at WID.
So we're going to be talking today about domestic violence. We've done a few podcast episodes, as I'm sure you've listened to, and if you haven't, you can go back into our backlog and listen to those. But it is really important for everybody to get sort of a foundational sense of what domestic violence looks like, especially because this is such a complex form of violence. Our theme this year for Domestic Violence Awareness Month is Beyond the Bruises, and that kind of connotates a lot. I'm actually going to ask you all that first. That theme, I know we had a lot of discussions around building it. What does that theme mean to you, or what do you want folks to kind of get from that theme this month?
I think for me, when I heard the theme first come up, I thought of, you know, sometimes when we think domestic violence, we only think of the physical aspect. And so for me, it was when saying beyond the bruises, it meant domestic violence can be more than just the physical aspect of it.
I'm kind of fresh into the DV field, and when I first heard it, I did initially think, like, okay, so we're talking about something that is beyond violence, but I didn't know specifically what that meant at the time. So I think it's very interesting that we're touching on this topic, especially because DV is so diverse in what it can look like, and I feel like social media has made it out to be more physical than it often is.
Yeah, and I think that's something, like, I don't know if it comes up in the presentations and stuff you all have done in the community or the talks, but I think that's something that comes up a lot when I'm out in the community, is just really emphasizing that fact that it's not just physical. I think folks often, even if they know emotional or mental or all these other types of abuse exist, they don't always take them as seriously. Mm-hmm. So I like that we're kind of focusing on that this year as a theme.
I was going to say, I also hear that, and it's kind of hard to combat when the laws and legislation say that domestic violence by law is physical, or there are different aspects that, you know, don't cover the full basis of what domestic violence is and what it means.
Absolutely. I think that's actually a great time to note the Florida statute. So, this can change from state to state or even in different countries, I've heard. But the Florida state statute around domestic violence, it defines it as any assault, aggravated assault, battery, aggravated battery, sexual assault, sexual battery, stalking, aggravated stalking, kidnapping, false imprisonment, or any criminal offense resulting in physical injury or death of one family or household member by another family or household member. So, you know, one thing about this definition that I think is a good point too, is it's not just intimate partners. You know, family or household member can mean a lot of different things. And, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to go into all of those lists, but it doesn't necessarily mean people in an intimate relationship. And that's good that it's maybe covering more, you know, instances of violence in that way, because domestic is home. But I think what you were kind of getting at, and what we often talk about in our work, is that physical injury or death piece, right? You have to have experienced physical injury, or the, you know, immediate threat of physical injury for this to really count, when that discounts a lot of what we think of as abuse.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's even why, you know, we tend to throw this term intimate partner violence around a little bit more in our field, because I think it kind of separates ourselves from that legal definition. And we, as advocates, still need to know the legal definition, especially as we're helping survivors navigate the court system and the criminal justice system and law enforcement and partnering with them. But I think, you know, a lot of our work in education and in awareness is building up the idea around, like, maybe a closer definition to what intimate partner violence is. So when you all are out in the community, how do you define intimate partner violence?
So, I mean, I talk primarily to teens, and I feel like the simplest explanation is the best, and it's about power and control. So when I was explaining it to some students, I said that it's a pattern of behavior where one person is trying to maintain power and control over the other. And that can look like a lot of different things, so I think that's why it's the best definition, because power and control isn't going to be the same for everyone. And a lot of the students said that for them, power and control is like controlling where they, who they hung out with, or what they wore, or who they could text, like things like that, which seems so mundane and like minuscule now that I am like so far removed from that life, but that's like so real for them in that stage of life. So I think this is the best definition for what it is.
Yeah, and I think the power and control piece, I know we use the power and control wheel, and listeners, you can feel free to Google that and look that up. But there's, you know, within that, I think you're right, it's a pretty comprehensive way to talk about violence, because then any behavior that's trying to limit this person's power or, you know, create this like system of control over them is then abusive. So what are some of those types of abuse in that kind of power and control dynamic?
I mean, the one I've heard about the most is gaslighting, which, if it's not common knowledge, it's when someone is trying to make your reality seem distorted. Elisa always gives a good example of the key on the hook. Like, say you come into your house and you have a hook right by the door that you put your keys on every day without fail. That's where your keys go. And then all of a sudden your partner says, you never put your keys there. And now you're questioning your own reality and what you know to be true just based on what they're saying. And it's that consistent denying of your reality that makes it a pattern of abuse.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a few others would be like sexual violence, emotional abuse, which kind of you talked to that issue with gaslighting, and that can look like a bunch of different things. Verbal abuse, so name calling or putting someone down about themselves, or saying certain things that you know are going to trigger them or upset them. Some other forms would be things like stalking, economic abuse, which could be, you know, financial abuse and either withholding money or not allowing the person to go to work because they are, you know, they've been abused and so they aren't able to go because there's maybe physical things going on that would raise red flags for people, or maybe their partners telling them, oh no, you know, you don't need to work, I'll take care of you, in order to isolate them and to kind of keep them in that power and control element.
Yeah, sometimes even the mental abuse of that too, like maybe you show up to work, but your performance or like what you're able to do isn't as good because you're carrying so much. Right. We often, when we're talking in the community, folks will say like, yeah, I saw a change in behavior in this person, or I saw, like, you can sometimes see it just in the way that they carry themselves. We still need to think about that invisible piece of like, you might be physically showing up to work. Right. And, and being able to keep that job, but you know, are you really present in there? I think DV just robs so much of people's lives and their joys from them that we don't often think about, because somebody's real life, it's not just like segmented into another aspect, right? DV often affects so much of it, and a lot of that's invisible.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are various, you know, different elements of that power and control wheel that we kind of talked about. I think the one that I think of the most is minimizing, denying, and blaming, because it's just something that we see like so often. And sometimes people don't even realize like that it's happening to them. And I think that's the core issue with a lot of these things, is some people don't even realize what's happening until it's like really happening and they're really in it. So the minimizing, denying, and blaming, saying things like, oh, it's not that big of a deal, and makes you kind of think, okay, is this actually a big deal? Like, am I overreacting? And if someone tells you that enough times, you're going to believe them. and it's going to become, you know, to where, yeah, maybe I am overreacting. Maybe this isn't a big deal. And that's when you kind of find yourself in the middle of it.
But I think you bring up a good point there too. And like, I know, again, we talk about this sometimes when we're in the community, but like there seems to be, there's not a lot of awareness or knowledge. And before I even started doing this education work, I'm not sure I had like a really clear picture of it, of like, mm-hmm. what is just, and I say just very lightly, what is like unhealthy or just maybe a tough patch or like a rough patch in the relationship versus, mm-hmm. no, this is actually abusive. Cause I think you're right. That's a pretty common tactic and something that like even well-meaning friends and family might say, you know, because they don't know that difference or they're not able to see that power and control element. So how do you all, when you're out in the community or doing this education or just in the way you think of it, how do you separate what's healthy versus unhealthy versus abusive?
I think for what I've seen so far, the best way to explain it is a consistent pattern. Well, I guess consistent isn't the word, but we talk about in the BOLD curriculum, the campaign for violence. And it's like, there can be cycles where, oh, he verbally abused me or they verbally abused me and then bought me flowers. And now I know that like anytime they have a really big fit, I'm going to get flowers. That's kind of like a cycle, but you don't know when, at what point that could happen.
Yeah.
The verbal abuse could occur. So I think that's a good distinction. It's like, it's a constant campaign and you don't know what it's going to look like and how it's going to affect you in that moment. And that's kind of where it gets from unhealthy to abusive, in that it goes from that cycle to now it's all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the best way I try to explain is that relationships are a spectrum, right? And so when we look at relationships, they look different for different people. You know, different people have different comfort levels or things that they're okay with and boundaries and things like that. And I think the easiest way for me to explain it is if one person is uncomfortable, but the other person is comfortable, then we're getting into that unhealthy aspect. If both people are comfortable, then that's a pretty healthy relationship. We're able to talk, we'll be able to communicate with each other, set boundaries without fearing that the other person might get upset or might react a certain way. And then when we, you know, leak into the abusive part is when someone, there's fear there. There's someone who's not only uncomfortable, but also at the point of they are fearful. If I don't text back fast enough, this person's going to get mad at me. Mm. If I don't do this correctly, this person's going to take their anger out on me. If I don't, you know, it starts to them kind of going down that hole of, if I don't do this, then this is going to happen to me, and has that fear element at the foundation of the relationship versus comfort being the foundation of the relationship.
I think that's like a really important thing to understand when trying to understand domestic violence, you know, especially when we think about like how much it happens. I sometimes hear in the community that like, oh, well, she's crazy or he's crazy or, you know, they're toxic. And I think it almost tries to paint it as like, well, this person is an outlier, you know, and this is just like crazy behavior, when really it is very deliberate and very like organized, and it's much more common than we think. Another kind of myth I've heard about domestic violence, in addition to, well, this person's just crazy and it's like an outlier sort of thing, is that it's caused by drugs and alcohol, right? And there's this myth in the community that alcohol and drug use or abuse is a major cause of domestic violence. And we know that that's false. Why is that false? Give our listeners a little bit of a sense of that.
Well, because we know that abuse, especially physical and things like the different types of abuse, can be, they're all learned behaviors, right? And so that alcohol and drugs isn't going to make you abusive. It just may exasperate, maybe make it a little bit more violent.
I think that's actually a reason that a lot of abusers will use, too, or a way that they'll manipulate their partner as well, to try to say, you know, I don't have a violence problem, I have this drinking problem, and I really need your support and you to stay with me to help with that, you know? And they kind of try to find, and they might legitimately have a substance abuse issue, which they should absolutely, you know, receive care for. But what's really important is that we see those things as independent problems. Solving the substance abuse issue won't solve the violence issue if the violence is deliberate and like a learned behavior, like you said. And I think there's kind of a similar myth around anger management, right? There's this kind of like idea about domestic violence. And we hear it sometimes even in the way that we talk about it, of, I just got so upset I broke your phone. I didn't mean to yell at you. I didn't mean to hit you. I didn't mean to, you know, slam the door. I was just really angry. And they kind of use that, like, lack of control over their anger as an excuse for abusive behaviors. So why is that not a good excuse either?
I think for me, when I hear that, first, I always go back to what is domestic violence? It's someone gaining and maintaining power and control. And when someone wants to gain and maintain power and control, and they're doing it specifically with one person and not with every single person they come into contact with, if someone has anger management issues, they're going to be angry with everyone and going to react that way with absolutely anyone who makes them angry, or if there's a situation, they aren't able to manage their emotions. And that is a very real issue that people deal with. But when we talk about domestic violence, it is someone specifically doing that to a specific person to gain and maintain power and control over them. That's why we so often hear people say, you know, when someone does finally speak up about what they're going through, we might hear them say, they're such a great person, or, I never saw this coming. So I think that's a, like, major difference between anger management and domestic violence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kind of on that too, there is a lot of misunderstanding about domestic violence from a lot of different angles, which is why we're doing this podcast and why we have a whole awareness month dedicated to it. But I think one of the other really common questions that comes up, and honestly, again, like I had before I started doing this work, before you really start thinking about it, is, you know, if we're looking at it as power and control, if we're thinking about it as it's not the victim's fault, then, you know, why is it so hard to leave, or why don't victims leave?
You know, this question was at the top of my mind when I was doing my trainings and I started, because for me, you know, I have a psych background and I know that, like, there's so much that goes into every decision psychologically. And so I knew, like, yeah, there's definitely got to be other factors for why you don't leave. But I'm like, oh, but if I was in that situation, I would just leave.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And it's so hard to get yourself out of that mindset and think, like, you don't know because you're not in it. So there's no way that you could quantify whatever psychological pressures, whatever economic ones. Financial abuse is one of those, like, invisible forms of abuse. And I feel like in my training so far, that's the one that has really stuck with me, because it can look like a lot of things. Like, maybe they ruin your credit card score so you can't rent an apartment by yourself, or maybe they completely take over your financials so you don't have any of your money in your name. Maybe they prevent you from working.
Yeah.
So it can look like so many things, but I guess for me, you just can't know. And I feel like the best thing to do while you see someone in that situation is to support as best as you can.
Yeah.
In whatever way that looks like, and not to victim blame.
Yeah, because I think even though this question, when it's asked, I think it's coming from a good place, or just like a helpful place, it often turns into a victim blaming thing of, like, why didn't you leave, versus why does this person feel like it's okay to treat you that way, and why aren't we holding them accountable, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that's a lot of the work that we're doing in the community, mm-hmm. and as an agency and as a DV movement, kind of on a larger scale, is really shifting the responsibility of the abuse to the person that's responsible, which is the abuser, right? The person choosing to abuse. You know, maybe they leave and they return. Even when they return to that abusive relationship, they're not choosing to be abused again. It's the abuser who's taking that new opportunity and choosing to continue their abusive behaviors. And I think that's a really big delineation. So you're right. I think, you know, a lot of our jobs as bystanders and as advocates is to be supportive. So how can they support survivors of domestic violence?
I think the first thing is just listening. People just, you know, if someone is coming to you and disclosing something this serious that's happening to them, it should be all ears. You know, I'm listening to you and you're trying to see where they're, understand what they're sharing with you. It can feel like a lot sometimes when someone comes to share something like this with us, but it's important to listen and actively listen to them. Show them empathy. Try and listen to where they're coming from and just support them in the ways that they're asking.
Yeah.
Sometimes that may look like helping them call a hotline. Sometimes that may just be listening. Sometimes that may be, you know, hey, can I stay on your couch for a few days? It could look different for different people. And for different roles that we play as advocates or as a friend or a family member, things like that. So just my first thing is listening and then asking the person, okay, how can I best support you? in this and seeing what that looks like for both of you, because you might have to set some boundaries. They might have some boundaries they also have, you know, in place of what they're comfortable with disclosing. They might be comfortable disclosing with you, but they might not be ready to call a hotline. Mm-hmm. Or they might, you know, want to just talk to someone and let someone know, hey, this is happening to me, but they might not be ready to leave.
Yeah.
We know that leaving an abusive partner is one of the most dangerous times of a relationship with someone. It's important for us to just support them in whatever way that they're at, whatever way that they're looking for, and not overstep those things either, because then we might, maybe then they won't come to us the next time. If they feel like overbeared, or like if they feel like the person's not listening to them, then you lose that opportunity and that person might not come to you again.
Yeah, I think that's really good guidance, because I think a lot of folks do get nervous to have these sorts of conversations, or if they're noticing the red flags, if they're kind of catching themselves victim blaming of like, oh, I can't believe you're back with them, right? Kind of separating ourselves and really knowing that most of the time our role as friends and family and support is just to be there, right? And to let this person guide the process, tell us what they need, but not doesn't mean you have to have the right answer for everything or know exactly what to do. A lot of it's just sending that message of, we believe you, we support you, you don't deserve to be treated that way.
Something I think of also is, this person already has lost their autonomy. This person's already feeling like a power struggle or is being controlled. And so the last thing they want is the person that they're going to also not respect their autonomy or make them feel less than, because they're already experiencing that. So it's so important that we are actively working towards helping them get back what they don't have any longer than to continue to like to add to that for them.
The one thing that I learned coming into WID is that we have this empowerment model, which is like what Alisa was saying. We're not trying to control anyone's life when they're trying to get away from a situation where their life was already being controlled. And so that's another part of like the autonomy that we have to give out all the autonomy back, because they lost so much of it in that relationship. Even if you think that this service or this opportunity is the best thing for them, they have to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be so hard in this field, especially when you mean the best for this person, but you also have to understand that they are still an individual, and your part of your job is to give them that individuality back.
So, yeah. The right to self-determination.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So just to start closing out our conversation, and I really appreciate y'all's opinions and thoughts and perspectives. It's been great to hear it, and I'm sure our listeners will appreciate it. But what is the action that you hope people take with this information?
That's a question. I just think back to what I tell teenagers, because I feel like when I was a teenager, I feel like I had no power. No ability to really make any kind of change. And yet, when I was 18 and 17, I was participating in protests, so I did have power. And I guess in the DV world, that could look like campaigning for someone that you know you may suspect is going through something. And whatever that may look like, by slowly like, oh, do you want to eat lunch with me? Or just like making yourself available to them. That can be look like so many different things, but I think it's so simple and it can be so impactful for someone who feels so utterly isolated and alone in this relationship.
Yeah.
I think the simplest thing is just being there, and I know that can be so like, that sounds so vague, but I really mean it in the most vague sense, because it could look like anything.
Yeah,
so
yeah, I would say that's a great way to start with action, and I think it's all about what the person is comfortable with. So your comfort level might be, okay, I can be here for someone. Whereas my comfort level might be, okay, I can be here for someone and I also want to advocate for this legislation. Or I can be here for someone, I want to advocate for this legislation and I want to volunteer. Like, it looks different for different people, and so I think just after hearing the information and kind of seeing like how you can be a part of an actionable change and how anyone can be a part of this, I think now looking at, you know, what does that look like for you? Like Brittany said, it looks different for different people. And kind of seeing what that feels like for you and trying different things out. You know, all the information you're learning, also sharing that with other people who are advocates, your friends and family, kind of sharing the information and making sure that, you know, when you learn something, you want to share that with other people. That's what advocacy is all about, is in education and prevention, is when we learn something, we want to make sure we're giving those tools to other people so that they can teach other people. And so it becomes like a snowball effect of change. I think that's one of the biggest things that we can do. And it's something as simple as, you know, if you see a behavior that someone's exhibiting that's a little unhealthy, telling them, hey, you know, I think that if you're in a safe place to do so, hey, I think we should talk about this. And kind of, you know, being a bystander, an active bystander, if you see something, saying something instead of just, oh, I saw that, let me just move on with my day. Sometimes we do that because we don't have time, or we, you know, we're in a lot of that rush thing. But knowing that you intervening and being an active bystander could mean the difference between someone, not to sound dramatic, but it can be the difference between life or death for someone. It could be the difference between someone understanding what's happening to them and not understanding what's happening to them. And I just think that if we all did a little bit more of that, then we would see so much change in the world.
Yeah. I mean, so many of the, you know, survivors that we help, we're not the first person they're talking to or have interacted with. They have family and friends who may have noticed, or they may have talked to. They may have gone to the doctors. They may have called the police, right? There are all these different people that are around in the community that can be those positive folks in people's lives to change their trajectory in a really positive way. So I agree.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much. Appreciate your perspective and your participation today. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
This episode of An Ounce of Prevention with Women in Distress was brought to you by the spectacular Education and Prevention team at WIB, a nonprofit certified domestic violence center in beautiful Broward County, Florida. Special thanks, of course, to Elisa, our education specialist, and Brittany, our teen dating violence specialist, for their time today and their amazing knowledge and commitment to the work. Stay in touch for more episodes and perspectives, with new episodes launching each month. Until next time, stay well, stay safe, and remember, violence is preventable. For everyone out there, please know that there is help if you or someone you know is experiencing dating violence, domestic abuse, or an unhealthy relationship. To talk to someone and get help, contact your local domestic violence hotline. If you're in Broward County, you can contact Women in Distress. Our crisis hotline is 954-761-1133. The statewide hotline in Florida to call or text is 1-800-500-1119. You can also contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline wherever you are at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233.